2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 272, Tidying Up Loose Ends, the November 2000 Excommunication of Margaret Toscano. Participants, Margaret Toscano, Daniel Rector, and Robert A. Reed.
Really terrific. And it's obvious that you'll be able to bootleg chairs, your chair, for a high price if you get yours now. And as far as I'm concerned, sitting on the floor is just okay. Now, I'm Levina Fielding Anderson, and I'm chairing this session. Am I audible back there? Okay. If you would, if you have a chair near you that's empty, would you raise your hand so that, hey, look at that. Okay, folks. Cross over, unless you're planning to walk out in protest and don't want to make too much of a... Now, I've been informed by the conference organizers that we have to be out of this room at 6:15, no matter what, or they won't be able to set up for the banquet tonight. But the Cascade 1 will be available, so if everybody... I'm going to actually end the session 5 minutes before... I'm going to cut off the last 5 minutes. But if Margaret and the two respondents would be so gracious as to get up while I'm still talking and saying this is what we're doing and go straight down to that room, then you can't even be stopped in the hall. So to continue the conversation, that's where we'll all need to go. Now, let me just fill you in with a little bit of background, which probably all of you already know. In June 1993, Cecilia Conchar Farr and David Clark Knowlton were informed by BYU that their contracts would not be renewed for the following year. This was well after the time when most faculty members at BYU had already received their contracts for the next year. After a fairly stormy summer, in September, there were 6 disciplinary actions that took steps against Lynn Whitesides, Paul Toscano, Abraham Gileotti, Michael Quinn, me, and Maxine Hanks. In the months that followed, Brent Metcalf and David Wright were also excommunicated. Michael, I'm blocking the name, Washington, D.C., Barrett, thank you very much. And action began against Janice Allred that ended in 1995 with her excommunication, and 2 more people either left BYU voluntarily or were strongly encouraged to leave. That was Brian Evanson and Gail Houston. But technically, it started with Margaret Toscano. Her state president, Carrie Hines, called her in and... was fairly stiff and severe with her about her pro-feminist activities. And at that point, Paul Toscano got involved and looked like a more promising target because he's known to be more cooperative and easier to intimidate than... than Margaret. So he became the target of opportunity that culminated in those events of September 1993. Then, in last November, in time for Thanksgiving, yes, immediately after, while the festivities were still going on, Margaret was called in and actions were initiated by her state president, a man whom she had met only once before, that culminated in her excommunication. In other words, there was a gap of 7 full years. And in a context that raises questions about why and when. Margaret has graciously consented to describe what happened as the context for that disciplinary action and also what happened at the disciplinary action itself. She... At her request, there was no publicity or vigils or outpouring of support that certainly would have been present at the time, because she was also trying to get ready for her orals and finish her dissertation, and her children did not want to go through the same kind of experience that had accompanied Paul's excommunication. But I think the presence of the people in this room, not all of whom are actuated by vulgar curiosity, indicates, Margaret, that there would have been a great deal of support for you if you had been willing to, or in a position to have accepted it. Now, our two respondents, I assume, without talking to them, that they are here to represent, to defend the state president, and to explain the missing piece about why it was necessary to excommunicate Margaret Toscano. Our first respondent will our first respondent will be Dan Rector, who is the former publisher of Sunstone, and with whom I dripped much wax on sidewalks at vigils in September of 1993, and Bob Rees, who has long been known for his compassionate stand on controversial issues of one form and another, and his willingness to offer Christian service in a variety of contexts, even when that includes calling people to repentance. I'll give you a little warning if I feel that that you're imprinting on the time, but otherwise we will just go in that order. Mm-hmm. Oh wait, I've got my receipt here. Okay, Margaret has her PhD in classics from BYU and is finishing. What do you mean, is finishing? You're through.
It's MA in classics
from BYU. All right, MA in classics from BYU, finishing her PhD in comparative literature at the University of Utah, and is in the last stages of her dissertation, Making Love with God, Sex and Identity in Two Late Medieval Women Mystics. Don't you wish you'd thought of that title? She is hoping to defend, finally, in October. Margaret has taught Greek, Latin, and classical myth and literature at BYU from 1975 to 1989, until they canceled her classes at the BYU Salt Lake Center in 1989, after she participated in the Mormon Women's Forum debate on women and the priesthood. She taught humanities at the Salt Lake Community College for 3 years, and has taught classics and liberal education classes at the University of Utah for the last 5 years, where she's a lecturer and an instructor in languages and literature. She received one of the few University of Utah university-wide teaching awards for the year 2000-2001 as published translations of some ancient Greek hymns. Margaret has participated frequently in Sunstone for the last 17 years, has published articles in Sunstone, Dialogue, and the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly, of which she's now the she was the founding editor, and she's the current editor of the Quarterly. She received the 1993 Utah National Organization of Women of Courageous Action Award, and with Paul co-authored Strangers in Paradox, Explorations in Mormon Theology.
My watch broke, so I brought my clock to keep me on time. I have three themes that I want to start with. I assume my voice is loud enough. My kids tell me I have an embarrassingly loud voice. And these themes, I think, are you're going to see through my discussion of my excommunication. The first theme is what is often put forth as a maxim in cultural anthropology. And it is this: what is culturally marginal may be symbolically central. The second one is what I would actually title my whole excommunication, which is the problem with niceness. And lastly, I want to sort of play with the interconnection between tragedy and comedy in this. So back to the culturally, what is culturally marginal may be symbolically central. My excommunication happened quietly without notice and really seemed to change nothing.
In a way, it simply made official what had already happened unofficially in 1993, my exclusion from the LDS Church. But I think that symbolically it represents what I see as the central ongoing problem that the LDS Church faces, both in terms of its mission to be a loving, gospel-centered Church of Jesus Christ, and also, I think, in its desire to be accepted as a legitimate and positive religious organization within the broader American society. And I see that central problem as the uses and abuses of authority. I also want to say that I think that my excommunication is a test case for how large or small the tent of the church is. Last night we had a discussion about the tent of Mormonism. So, what I want to do is first of all explain to you what happened, and then I want to draw some conclusions from this. Levina has set up a little bit of the context, but I want to go back just briefly. As she mentioned, in 1993, the series of excommunications really started with a threat to me. In that summer, I had given a presentation to the BYU Voice Club, which is a feminist club, which is a slideshow that some of you may have seen about images of God the Mother. Well, it got written up in the BYU Daily Universe. Their faculty advisor was away, and they put my picture on the front page of the Daily Universe. Boyd Packer saw it. He was furious and made a few phone calls and put some pressure on my state president, Kerry Hines. Kerry Hines called me in. In his sort of honesty, he let it out that Boyd Packer had been upset about this, and also that he had had some pressure. In fact, he even quoted to me, why can't he control that woman? someone said to Kerry. Well, we had a series of discussions. It started out doctrinally. And when he saw that he really couldn't outdo me there, that there was not really, he had a lot of arguments against the woman in the priesthood issues, he quickly went to the issue of authority and told me that he wanted me to promise him that I would no longer talk about these issues and that it should simply be a matter of obedience. Well, then we started into a series of discussions about obedience, and which finally culminated in a letter that he sent to me where he asked me, he basically demanded and said that I couldn't speak, publish, write, discuss, in any forum, public, any media presentation, any kind of context, anything to do with church history and doctrine. If I did, it was very, very all-encompassing. If I did, they would hold a disciplinary council on me. At that point, Paul got involved in the discussion. I have described it, and actually Kerry Hines also described it, as him jumping to my defense in sort of a gallant way. And as Levina also mentioned, President Hines quickly saw that he was much more offensive than I was. I mean, I'm known for my niceness, and Paul is known for his abrasiveness. And so, you know, it's hard to excommunicate a nice woman. I mean, what gentleman could do this, right? But an abrasive man, I mean, it's you know, the more gentlemanly thing to do. So Paul was the one that was excommunicated. We continued to live in that ward for 2 years. A few months after Paul's excommunication, actually after the excommunication, neither Paul nor my daughters wanted to return to church. I tried for a few months until one of my daughters confronted me, my youngest daughter, who was only 9 at the time. And from her perspective, for me to continue to go to church was a betrayal of her and the family. And she basically said to me, "You choose. Us or the church." And so, of course, I chose the family, and I stopped going to church and discovered my anger. We lived there for about 2 years, then we moved to a new house, which was an entirely different stake.
only a mile or so away, but a different steak. When we first moved in, we got the usual LDS visitors, you know, Relief Society, etc. When we told them that we were excommunicated apostates, they left us alone, and we didn't hear from anybody. The next thing I heard was in July of 1998, Paul and I had returned from a trip to Europe. I had a phone call from a Bishop Warnick. The stake that we had moved to, we had been in the Big Cottonwood stake, Salt Lake City Big Cottonwood stake. We had moved into the South Cottonwood stake. Bishop Warnick called me in. I had never met the man. Decided I would go in and see what he had to say. A very nice man, intelligent, thoughtful, embarrassed about calling me in. Although he gave the usual church line about, oh no, no one asked me to do this. He focused our discussion on Strangers in Paradox. He said he had only read one chapter, the chapter on polygamy, which he said he actually liked. But then he asked me about the typical thing, Mother in Heaven, Women in the Priesthood, two of the big issues that I've written on. We probably talked for an hour and a half, a very friendly discussion. At the end, he said, I was so afraid to talk to you, but really, you're a rather pleasant person. I'm not sure what he was expecting, you know, the feminist ogre or something. Anyway, and at the very end, he also let slip, he said, I hope I don't have to do anything. So that was the end of that meeting, 1998. The next thing I heard, September of 1999, I had a call from Dale Blake, who is the stake president of the South Cottonwood stake. I'd never met him, didn't know anything about him. He asked me if I would come in and talk to him on a Sunday. Again, I decided that I would. So I went into his office. He was in there with his first counselor. I never have known this man's name. I'm sure he was introduced to me, but I forgot it. It started out, Dale Blake is a sort of friendly fellow. He has a big grin, shook my hand. In all of my contact with him, he called me Sister Tascano. Sister Tascano, so good that you could come in. Please sit down. I looked at him rather quizzically. You know, what is this about? He said to me, I just wanted to get to know you. And I sort of said, well, you know, I've been in the stake for 5 years and no one has been much interested in getting to know me. I'm wondering what this could be, you know, that all of a sudden you're interested. And he said, well, you know, I just want to get to know you. He kind of hemmed and hawed. And I said, well, I mean, do you know anything about me? You know, do you know that my husband was excommunicated with a September 6th and so forth? And he said, well, I have talked to President Hines. Well, the meeting lasted an hour and a half, and I'm afraid that I disclosed a lot more than he did. The only thing that he really brought up in that meeting is that he said, I'm really concerned about the anti-Mormon website that you and your husband have. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, as I sort of questioned him, what came out was that it was a page from the Signature Book website that was advertising Strangers in Paradox. And he saw this as an anti-Mormon website, so there you have it. So that was the end of that. I didn't hear anything from him for a year. The next I heard, November 26th, actually a few days before that, I get a call from his executive secretary who says the state president would like to see you. I had determined after that first meeting that I didn't want to have any series of meetings, that there was really no purpose in them, and I was just going to tell him no. But he didn't call, the executive secretary did, and so I thought, well, I'll go in, let's just end this. So I go in, again, the friendly. I have to say that my first impression of President Blake was that at least he played the part of the fool, the kind of happy-go-lucky, not very intelligent person. So I come in, and he, very friendly again, oh, Sister Tascano, it's so good to see you. How is your husband doing? How are the kids? And I kind of, well, they're fine. And then the next thing I know, he hands me a letter, and he says, I have a letter for you. And it is a summons to appear in a church disciplinary council. This is this first sentence. The stake presidency is considering formal disciplinary action in your behalf, including the possibility of disfellowshipment or excommunication, because you are reported to have been in apostasy. All of you English teachers out there, a more passive sentence never existed. Because you are reported to have been in apostasy. So I said, well, who reported me and what are the charges? Oh, we don't need to get into that right now, he said. That's what the council is for. But, he said, I want you to know that if you do want to bring witnesses, you have to have their names and a detailed list of what they're going to testify about to the bishop by tomorrow night. So, then I said, well, if you don't have anything, won't tell me the charges, I do have some issues that I'm concerned with. And I quickly said about five things. You know, what is your definition of apostasy? There were several things. I won't go into those for time's sake. Then I asked him, was he given any information by any church committee or leader? And I tried to word this in a clever way so that he couldn't slip out of it. But he said that he had had no contact with any other leader or that he hadn't been sent any information by any church committee. And then he said, I feel so sad that you have such a low opinion of the church and that you think that they have secrets, that we have secrets. And then it was a short meeting. I got up to leave. The smile again. Oh, Sister Tascano, I hope you have a great day. I began to laugh. I said, you've got to be kidding. Oh, no, I mean this very sincerely, he said. He also emphasized that the meeting would start 7 o'clock sharp and I'd better be there on time, which I assured him that I would be. So the court started at 7 o'clock, November 30th, a Thursday, teaching week. Had to teach the next morning at 9:30, a Latin class, but I was there. After I had been given the summons by the state president, I determined in my own mind that I did not want to have this be a public spectacle of any sort or to have anybody there. My first reason was really my concern about my daughters. Paul's excommunication was very hard on them. They suffered a lot from it. And when I went home and told them that there was another court, one of my daughters said, oh no, do we have to go through all that embarrassment again? So there was no way, and I'd actually decided before then that I was going to put them through that again. Also, just because of my being in the never-ending dissertation and so forth, I just couldn't deal with the trauma that we had been through with Paul. So I decided to go by myself. I didn't tell anybody except for Paula, my daughters, went alone that night. When I arrived there, the building was rather dark, which surprised me. They had told me to come in through the back way, which I did. I learned later that they were expecting a big vigil. And in fact, they had all the doors locked so that no one could get in. And they had one door open, which was where I had been instructed to come. They had a guard there, one of the bishops in the stake, who was not to let anybody in except for me. I went in, greeted by the executive secretary. He went and got the state president, who had been talking to the high council. He took me in. And so my first impression, it was a little bit daunting, because there were 16 men in there, all in their suits and so forth. They had it set up with a long table this way where the state president and his two counselors sat, the executive secretary here. The high council were sitting in a semicircle. They had a chair for me right here. I was wearing a dress. Lavanya asked me about, you know, I mean, what do you wear to an excommunication, right? I wore a suit, a conservative suit. But the skirt was such that I did have to do that thing about you keep your knees together, right, at all times, because I was kind of right there in front of them. As soon as I came in, all of them rose to their feet. And in fact, this became almost a humorous thing in the council. Every time I would stand up, they all jumped to their feet. If I sat down, then they would sit down, so we could kind of go, you know, the playing on this. Very polite. They all wanted to shake my hand. So I had to go around and be introduced to all of them, shake their hands. It was all very polite and nice. Introductions, etc. Then all of a sudden, the bumbling, happy-go-lucky, little stupid state president becomes the articulate public prosecutor. And in fact, another image of this court is a sort of Kafkaesque quality. The man who had said he had never mentioned that he was familiar with anything that I had written, except for the supposed anti-Mormon website, had in front of him a stack this high, Xerox copies of everything, well, not everything, they did miss a few things, that I had written, including transcripts of things that I know were never published. So they would have had to have been transcribed from tape. Also copies of most of the magazine newspaper articles where I was quoted. He also had a script, a typewritten script in front of him, which he followed very closely. And with this, what he did is that, as I said, he proceeded in a sort of public prosecutor-like fashion to present his case against me to show that I was guilty of apostasy. And, of course, one of the questions that this raises is that did he prepare the script himself? I mean, I'm certainly convinced that he was not as stupid as he appeared in the first meeting I had with him. The script is another issue that I want to come back to. He started with a definition of apostasy, and all of those of us who were in the 1993 excommunications memorized these things, but for those who may have forgotten, the church handbook gives basically two definitions of apostasy. The first one is clear, open, deliberate, and repeated opposition to the church and or its leaders. The second one is teaching as church doctrine what is not church doctrine after being corrected by a leader. What he then said is that he read the definitions and he said, what I'm going to show you tonight is that Sister Toscano, although I better quit that little thing, Sister Toscano was instructed by her leaders to not talk about certain things, and I want to show you how she was in disobedience to her leaders, thank you very much, and disobeyed what they did, and therefore that she is guilty of apostasy. Then he let me give an initial statement at this point. He had already mentioned at this time Kerry Hines, that I had been commanded by Kerry Hines not to publish and write, and that I had continued to do so. And so basically the argument was a very legalistic one. If you disobey, if a leader has told you to do something and you disobey, you are in opposition to that leader, therefore you are an apostate. And that was all he felt that he had to demonstrate. So he had mentioned that Kerry Hines had instructed me. So then he let me give a little response. And I said that, told the council that when President Hines had given me these instructions, that I had had a conversation with him about it and told him that I was not going to obey it, because I felt like that the command itself was not righteous, that it was not within the power that he had, acting as a loving leader of representing Jesus Christ, to ask me to do this. I had told President Hines that I felt that if I obeyed his order to not talk or publish, it wasn't just that I thought that it was so important that I had things to say, but that it would be setting up and participating in what I thought was an abusive act. And that to participate in this abusive act, to be silent, not only hurt me individually and my relationship to the community, but that it damaged the entire community of saints, because it reinforced notions of obedience and of silence and of negation of freedom of speech that I felt were spiritually damaging to the whole community. It would promote fear and oppression and reinforce a model of community that I disagreed with, is what I told him. I then also said that I had never used my church membership to get people to believe me, that I had never said my most controversial things in especially the Sunday school class that I was then team teaching with Fred Voros, that I had always left my most radical ideas for Sunstone and other such groups, which for me was an important distinction. I also said that I disagreed with the definition of apostasy because I felt like it promoted arbitrary action, that it promoted the idea that anything a leader says is right. At this point, President Blake interrupted and he said, "Oh no, a church leader would never ask you to do anything that is not right." And then he kind of quickly qualified and said, "Well, maybe they would tell you not to bring cereals for your kids for sacrament or something small like that, but nothing important would a church leader tell you to do that's not right." Then I responded, "Well, let me talk about the issue of blacks and the priesthood." Immediately, mid-sentence, he interrupted me and he said, you may not lecture us. We will not allow you to lecture us. And you may not talk about issues like blacks and the priesthood. You may not bring that issue up again. And in fact, you can only talk as I give you permission. And if I feel like that you are misusing this, I will stop you immediately. Well, this was a little scary, and in fact, I said nothing else at that moment. Then President Blake asked me a little bit about my instructions from Kerry Hines. And he was sort of asking me, "Well, what do you think he meant here?" And I said, "Well, you know, you'd have to really ask President Hines." Then we had the courtroom drama. President Hines happens to be here. In comes the surprise witness. He brings in Kerry Hines. Kerry Hines sits down, looks a little uncomfortable. Then we have the surprise evidence. Out comes the letter that Kerry Hines had sent me 7 years before. President Blake has one of the counselors read it. Just a couple of points I want to emphasize. It's interesting that in that letter, President Hines was very careful not to get onto doctrinal issues. He said, "Your beliefs are not being questioned. This is personal to you. I'm simply asking you to obey me out of a test of your faith," is the way that Kerry Hines had put it. Then President Blake questioned President Hines, and I think this may have been some of the source of the little discomfort of President Hines. He asked him whether or not I had disobeyed the letter. Oh, he also did this dramatic thing of, "President Hines, did you send this letter?" "Yes, I did." "Sister Tascano, did you receive this letter?" "Yes, I did." So we had quite a bit of courtroom drama here. But then he asked him, "Did I disobey the letter?" "Yes, she had." "Did you have discussions about this?" "Yes, we did." "Did she ever use her Sunday school class to push her radical doctrines?" "No, she didn't," President Hines said. "As far as I heard, she was a very good teacher." Then he asked him, and I think this was the discomfort, why didn't he follow up on the letter? You know, why didn't he pursue me after I disobeyed him? So, of course, here we have another drama. President Blake as the champion who is doing his duty as a priesthood leader, as opposed to Kerry Hines, who had somehow dropped the ball. President Hines gave three reasons. First of all, he said that Paul was very protective of me and that Paul had told him not to contact me. This startled me because it didn't sound like something that Paul would do. First of all, he knows I'd be really mad if he said that. it's fine to be protective, but, you know, Paul's not the kind who's going to try to control me. But, you know, it surprised me. The second thing he said is that I had already removed myself from the church, which was the fact that I wasn't attending after a couple of months. Third, he said that we had moved out of the stake. Of course, it had been 2 years after the excommunication before we moved out of the stake. I was then given a little chance to respond. I told about my reason for the inactivity, that it had been because of my concern for my children and my relationship with them. They let me ask a couple of other questions. The thing I was interested in is how the exchange had gone between President Blake and President Hines, whether or not my records had been tagged, whether or not President Hines had made the initial call, how this had gone. Neither one of them really gave me any information. They kind of hem-hawed and kind of wouldn't answer that. President Hines did not stay long. As soon as those questions were gone over, he left. Then at that point, President Blake went back to the prosecuting attorney, and he had, as I said, this script where he went down all the ways in which I had disobeyed the leaders. Interestingly, he didn't just simply start with the speeches that I had given after the 1993 letter, but he went clear back to my first publication, which was a 1985 Sunstone article, which had been a reprint, or it had been the printing of my first Sunstone speech, which was the missing rib. And then he went and basically hit every single one of my speeches, again, missing a few. For example, I don't think anyone listens to KRCL. I hosted a feminist radio show there for about 4 or 5 years. They never mentioned that. But they mentioned most of my major presentations at Sunstone, articles in Dialogue, Mormon Women's Forum presentations, and also publications. And as I said, newspaper articles as well. He had a Xerox copy of Strangers in Paradox. The major issues that he was concerned with were women in the priesthood and Heavenly Mother. But again, it was interesting that he focused not on the content, and of course he would never let me argue doctrine with him. It was always the fact you had been commanded not to talk about any of these things, and you did, therefore you were an apostate. He quoted, for example, a 1993 newspaper article during the September 6th where I said, "I will not be silent." Another interesting little tidbit here is that the one thing that he had that wasn't a Xerox copy was my images of the female body, human and divine, which is kind of a complex piece on symbols and how they work. And his main objection to that was that it had lewd pictures in it. And he was not letting me answer much. I quickly kind of tried to jump in a little bit when I could, and I said, "Well, I don't consider those lewd pictures." Oh, and he said, "And they're lewd pictures that she said could be images of our Heavenly Mother." You know, God forbid. And I said, "Well, first of all, I don't consider them lewd pictures." And he said, "Well, there are naked bodies in there." And I said, "Well, I don't consider the human body lewd." So little things like that. For a 1993 Sunstone speech, it was part of the panel, "If Mormon Women Have Had the Priesthood." Mike Quinn, myself, Maxine Hanks, Linda Newell had talked at the symposium. In that speech, I had disagreed with a talk by President Packer where he, in response to probably me and Mike Quinn and others who had written on priesthood, had said there is no free-floating temple priesthood. And I had sort of engaged in a little bit of a theological debate with Packer's talk. President Blake used that as another example of me disobeying leaders, that by disagreeing with Boyd Packer in that way and the talk, by, you know, debating with him, that I was disobeying leaders. Interestingly, he, in everything that he quoted to the High Council that I had written, he would take maybe a phrase or a sentence. When he tried to show that I was in disagreement and disobedience with Packer, he probably read a 5-minute passage from Packer, looking at me in a sort of glaring way all the time as though, you know, be instructed, this is the true doctrine. That was as doctrinal as the whole thing got. Again, he would not let me really defend. He also, there was a panel that I was a part of, and then also a speech that I gave where I talked about praying to Heavenly Mother. He did the same thing. He brought in a talk from President Hinckley about how we shouldn't pray to Heavenly Mother. At this point, I tried to defend myself a little by talking about the hymn, O My Father, the whole idea of what do we mean by a prayer. I also made the distinction of, you know, it's not like I was telling women to get up in defiance in sacrament meeting and, you know, kind of defy the priesthood leaders and say, you know, pray to Heavenly Mother. I said, rather, this is more about trying to encourage women who have often been very damaged by a patriarchal system to be able to connect with God in whatever way that they can. And I said, maybe this is hard for you to understand, but, you know, there are women who have been, who have felt abused, who have a very hard time with the idea of this male God. And I said, just look here at this council. I'm one woman. There are 16 of you men. You know, this can be, you know, there are no women in leadership positions that can represent my feelings and what I feel here. President Blake immediately got very defensive. He said, oh, I hope that you don't feel like we're intimidating you or that this, you know, that we're trying to hurt you in any way. And I said, well, you know, I mean, I teach and I'm in academia and I'm kind of used to dealing with tough situations, but that's not the point here. The point is that this is an inequality of power. It's an imbalance of power. So we did have that little exchange. The last thing that he ended with was my 1998 dialogue article, If I Hate My Mother, Can I Love the Heavenly Mother? This was the one piece that he actually said he liked something in it. He said that it was helpful for him to read about my description of my mother's depression because it helped him understand me. But he was a little disturbed by my image of God as lover in that piece. So after he had gone, and he took probably about an hour to do all of this, then he gave me a little chance for a response. I hadn't really had much chance to say anything. By this time, I realized that it wasn't going to help to try to argue doctrine. And so, I mean, I had no preparation for this, but I decided that I would go for the freedom of speech argument, which, in fact, turned out to be something that was really disturbing to them. So I argued for freedom of speech and free agency, kind of elaborating what I had started out at the beginning with these two doctrines as essential both for moral choice, individual growth, and healthy community. And I talked to them a little bit about what my vision of a healthy spiritual community would be like. I also told them that I had no intent to harm the church, that I wasn't its enemy, that I had never intended that, that in fact, from a very young age, I had loved the church, that I had seen my feminist theology as faith-promoting, that it was my way of trying to come to grips with my tradition, with my faith, and to work out a space that I felt like I could live in, and that if possible, maybe I could help other women and men too. I also said that I had always tried to be a devout member of the church, had an intense desire to understand the gospel. So I tried to give them that context. I should also say I knew none of these people. I'd never had any association with them. They didn't know me. Oh, okay. I don't care at this point. Then I went for the inspired Constitution argument, that if the Constitution is inspired in any way, it seems that it has to be the Bill of Rights, and again, the argument about freedom as the basis for individuality. And I argued that there should be a place in the church for disagreement. and talked about how that if we don't have freedom of speech, that it creates a climate of fear, and that I had talked to many people who had felt afraid to speak from their heart in any kind of a church context. At this point, I mean, again, I didn't feel like I could elaborate too much. I had to quickly get in whatever he would let me. Then we went to a question and answer where he allowed the high council to ask me questions. And let me just quickly go through these. The first man started by complimenting me on being articulate and passionate. Several times they complimented me on being passionate, and I'm not sure what that meant, but I guess it was a compliment. He asked me whether I had plans to publish more articles on feminism, and I said, right now, all I want to do is finish my dissertation. Second question, someone asked about the free speech issue, and he gave me the extreme case. What if there's a white supremacist who's arguing for blacks killing blacks? Should the church excommunicate such a person? You know, afterwards, of course, you think of all sorts of good arguments. At this point, I just said, well, you know, from my perspective, I'm pretty strong on freedom of speech. Basically, I think speech should be countered with speech and action with action. That if somebody says something that's really wrong, the church should make a clear public denunciation of that thing. Next question, why did I come tonight? Why did I decide to come when I've been inactive for so long? I gave him three answers. First of all, I said, Mormonism is my heritage. Part of me will always be Mormon, I said, even if you excommunicate me. Secondly, I said I wanted to come to bear my own witness. I didn't want them to be able to cut me off without having to look me in the face. I wanted them to see the kind of person I was. Thirdly, I said that I came because I felt that to do so was a way of trying to help the church be a better organization. That I wanted the church to be a loving, fair, just, nurturing organization, and unless all of us worked for that, that it would never be. At this point, President Blake said, President Blake liked it too. He goes, that's good. He said, I agree with that. We all want that too. The fourth question, were the topics of my speeches assigned to me? I think they thought Sunstone was like church. Or were they my own ideas? I said they were my own ideas. Sometimes there were panels where we had a theme, but my own ideas. I take responsibility. Fifth question, do I still pray? Yes, I said. Six, and this was a hard one. He said, a very kind of gentle man, did I speak from my heart? And I wasn't sure what he was asking. I said, well, I've tried to. I've tried to be sincere. Seven, what do I think about the church now? I said, I think two things. First of all, I think the church does good. There are people that it helps. It helps, it gives people meaning. It gives people a sense of purpose. But I said, the church also does a lot of harm. The church hurts a lot of people, and they don't take responsibility for that. Next, the next little section is they did the Doctrine and Covenants thing of drawing lots, which they had done before. He had explained, I knew, of course, about this, but he had told me they were going to do this. The idea that the High Council is supposed to be split, six for you, six against you. He said in kind of consideration of time, we've chosen two who are going to be against you and two for you. And then he said, now, they were really worried that you would be really offended and you would think they were attacking you. So I want you to know that this is their job and they had to do it. I said, that's fine, I understand. So both of the ones that were against me started out with a statement of their belief in the freedom of speech and free agency. So I knew I'd really gotten them there. He started out and he said in a really fierce way, I fought for free agents and free agency in the war in heaven, and I will still fight for it. But, bottom line, you didn't obey your leaders, therefore you are an apostate. The first man four was the man who had asked me whether I spoke from my heart, a very kind of sweet man. He said he'd been moved by my love for my daughters. He felt my testimony of Christ in the church. He felt I had good intentions. Third went against me. He also began by, I believe in freedom of speech. and he also complimented me. I was intelligent, articulate, passionate, so that kept coming up. He said I was well-meaning but misguided. The church, then he said, and this is really quoting from the handbook, the church must protect the innocent. It must safeguard the purity of the church. Some people may have been misguided by me. I had placed in jeopardy people's testimonies. I had disobeyed after being warned. Therefore, I was an apostate. Finally, the last one, four, and it was hard to tell really which side he was on. He said there was the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. I had kept the spirit and disobeyed the letter. Then they asked me to leave. They deliberated for about a half an hour. This is where I found out that the man guard at the door, who was the bishop, had been put there as the guard. So after half an hour, they called me back in. The stake president began with a series of compliments. He said that the high council had wanted me to know how much they had been impressed with me. I was so nice and polite and lived by my ideal to disagree with respect. I was so intelligent and articulate and passionate. That was the third time. But I was so excommunicated. It was not quite like that, but almost. It was almost a parody. It was like, you know, 10 compliments, and the decision of the unanimous decision of the court is that you are excommunicated from the church. Then he explained to me what this meant, that I had no privileges of membership. Told me that I could come back, and here all of a sudden he switched the discourse. Whereas before, the whole thing had been, you had been given this letter, you disobeyed leaders. All of a sudden now, it was, I could come back, but in order to do so, I would have to denounce all of my false doctrine. He reinforced this interpretation when I got a letter from him almost 3 weeks later, where he, you know, said, you are officially excommunicated, this is why, and he said, if you want to come back, it's going to be a long, hard road. You will have to make a full public denunciation of all of your false doctrines, and you will have to try to make restitution to all the people whose testimonies you've damaged. Of course, they had not shown either one of those, either that I had taught false doctrine or that I had hurt anybody, but now that was the condition for getting back in. I must try to restore their faith. So, it was over. Oh, he also, at the very end, reverted to the smarmy guy, wondered if he could keep in touch with me. I said, that's okay. Don't call me at home, though. It's upsetting to my family if you want to call me at my office, and he took down my office number. Never heard from him, of course, until this week after the Sunstone program had come out. There was a message on my phone that said, oh, Sister Toscano, President Blake here, just wondering how you're doing. I'll get back with you. So I stand up. They all jump up. They all want to shake my hands again. I go, I have to shake everybody's hand again. Yes, you do. Congratulations, you won. Then President Blake and his counselor wanted to walk me out to my car. It was 10:15 by this time. It had gone a little over 3 hours. I said, well, you know, okay. At this point, President Blake is relieved, happy, very pleased with himself, and he lets slip that they were afraid that Paul would come, because I said, well, you know, Paul wanted to come and kind of be here to support, but I really wanted to be here by myself. Well, President Hines had told us how protective Paul is of you, and we were a little afraid that he might come here and cause some trouble. Afraid he might be a little belligerent. He also let slip that they were expecting a big vigil. And I said, well, at that point I said, well, I wanted to have this quiet for the sake of my children. Well, we were glad you did. We were expecting you might have a lot of people. The aftermath. I have to admit that at first I was relieved. In a way, I kind of describe it as in 1993, I feel like I was fatally wounded and left to die at the side of the road. So it's sort of like the mercy death, right? Also, I didn't want to go through the thing that Janice did, where first you're disfellowshipped and then you have to do another damn trial, right? To be excommunicated. So I was very relieved. I got home, My daughters were also relieved. They sort of helped me cheer up by telling me jokes. Right after Paul had been excommunicated in September, the church machinery is efficient. When we'd received our ward Christmas card, the Christmas right after, 2 months after Paul was excommunicated, the card was addressed to the Margaret Toscano family. And so this is the way the women can get in charge, right? We have to excommunicate all the men. So Angela joked, well, I wonder if the Christmas card is going to be addressed to the Angela Toscano family. And they said, maybe they'll pick us off one by one and we'll each have our chance to have the Christmas card addressed to us. So they joked and they were really cute and wonderful. And I told them all about it and so forth. Also, by that time, we had told our good friends Fred and Vicki Voros. Fred was out of town, but Vicki and her daughter Julia were there, and Paul had bought pastries, so we kind of had our little celebration. So my initial relief, though, was followed by 3 days of extreme grief and sadness. Couldn't stop crying the next morning. I had to teach Latin at 9:30, so it was a cool morning, and I kind of walked around, and I got out the makeup, you know, and applying makeup. I told very few people, called Levina on Sunday because I wanted to record the whole thing. Wanted to keep it quiet. I want to now go from this sense of sadness to raise a couple of questions, and I'm going to go over these really fast because I also want to give my respondents a chance. I want to raise the questions that Levina had asked. You know, first of all, why now? You know, why did it take so long? I have a couple of possible answers, but no final ones for any of these. One of them is that I feel the wheels of bureaucracy move slowly but inexorably. I think that it was sort of written already in the fates that I was going to be excommunicated, but I think Carrie Hines really didn't push through with it because Paul's excommunication was painful for him. His name got dragged through the paper. It was very painful. I don't think he wanted to repeat that. When they moved into the new stake, I think it took time. You know, they wanted the bishop. I think they wanted the bishop to hold the court. That's how the church policy is. I don't think he would do it, my impression. I don't know for certain. So finally, the stake president did it. I think they were building their case. I mean, that carefully scripted work, all of the documents, I think it took time. So I think those are a couple of reasons. Why in this way? Who instigated it? My impression from what I saw, even though I'm certain that President Blake is not a fool, he's not a stupid man, I really do not think that he wrote the script. I'm certain that he did not go through all the newspaper articles and collect those. And so, of course, this means that he lied to me. He was very deceptive with me. I think he had help. I assume it was the strengthening the membership committee. Maybe one of the church attorneys prepared it. It was very, very well done, very clever. Then, of course, the question of why. All the reasons, I think, why they excommunicate me fall under the umbrella of church identity and authority. Some of you last night may have been in the excellent discussion about Mormon identity and community, the question of how big is the Mormon tent. And what I want to add to this discussion, and I think, in fact, my excommunication very much has a lot of ramifications for that question. The Mormon tent may be big, but I think the LDS tent isn't. There was one important point, I think, that was not stressed enough last night. Someone mentioned there the church press release, I think it was in spring or something, where they said, you know, we don't want to be called Mormons, we want to be called the Church of Jesus Christ, if you're going to shorten it. And, of course, it seems like one of their motives there may have been that they want to self-identify as Christians. They want to be identified as the larger Christian, part of the larger Christian community. But I think that there's also the issue that by emphasizing that we are the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints rather than the Mormons, what they are doing is not allowing other people to self-identify as LDS. Thus, by insisting that the church not be called the Mormon Church, they are eliminating the possibility of people connecting to the church through their ethnicity or cultural or family connections. In other words, they want LDS identity to be strictly about official membership in the church, which only they have control over. And I think that that was very clear in my counsel, this idea that they didn't want me speaking as a member of the church, that it was very important to them that I be silenced as a member of the church. At the very end of the excommunication, when he announced that I was excommunicated, President Blake made a very odd analogy, I thought. He said, you know, the church is like a social club. That just as a club has the right, the legal right, to set up rules that you have to obey in order to be a member of that club, you did not obey the rules of this club, and we have the right to kick you out. At the time, it struck me very ironically. I thought, you know, I would have been better if I had only been a social Mormon. My real problem in all of this was that I cared too much. I believed too much. I cared about doctrine. I cared about what the spiritual community was like. If I had been a social member, or even an atheist who just had family connections, I probably would never be in this spot. Last night when Armin Moss was giving his normative constituencies, I was laughing to myself. I thought, you know, I should have joined the Hunting and Fishing Mormon group, for any of you that were there, because, you know, you have less chance of being kicked out of the church if you're just one of those hunting and fishing Mormons than if you're one of those who is a true believer. The second thing I want to say about identity, and here again I want to play a little bit on the panel last night, Armin said that if members don't think you are trying to hurt the church or are an enemy of it, that they will accept you. That has been his experience, which I respect. And while I agree with him that there's some truth in this, I also believe that the church and its members absolutely need enemies and apostates. It is only by creating boundaries between themselves and others, by creating an other with a capital O, right, that they have a meaningful identity. And I think that this is part of what it's about. Exclusion is essential for their own feelings of righteousness. And I think that part of this is what they mean by they have to protect the purity of the church. Because there are those who can't go to the temple, this makes those who can feel special. There have to be the impure in order for the pure to feel clean. Safeguarding the so-called innocent against dangerous people like me creates a sense of purity and purpose. And of course, there are all sorts of authority issues here which I don't have time to go into, so I want to just quickly mention a couple. One of the scary things to me about the letter that the state president sent to me later is that he made the statement that the current opinions of the leaders are absolute, that neither the scriptures or any dead prophet holds up against the current leaders, that the only standard of truth that we have in the church is the current leaders. And so, of course, one of the things that this does is that this creates this leader-member dichotomy, which I think, again, is very essential for Mormon identity right now. I wish I had time, but I don't, to focus just a little bit on the feminist issues. I think it's very important that the two things that they're very upset about that I talked about, women in the priesthood and God the Mother, especially when you consider that both of these doctrines are based in church texts and church rituals, that I can't think of anything more Mormon than women having the priesthood in the temple or Heavenly Mother. These both go back to Joseph Smith. There's a long tradition. But they're considered absolutely a threat to the present structure. Just quickly, yesterday there was a discussion between Lynn Matthews Anderson and Molly Bennion, both of my love, wonderful talks. But we had the same good girl, bad girl dichotomy. Lynn being her feisty, satirical self, Molly saying, look, if we're too critical, we just get kicked out. The church won't let us speak. So we're in this polarized situation. This takes me to the niceness thing. Niceness and its consequences. My niceness versus Paul's abrasiveness. The interesting thing is that ultimately it didn't matter. Back in 1993 when we had the September 6th, I had heard a lot of people creating a hierarchy of the excommunicants who deserved it more than others. You were considered pretty pure, Levina. Paul was pretty impure. He deserved it. He was mean. He was critical. He made fun of the leaders. He was not nice. I was so nice. They excommunicated me. The politeness of the disciplinary council covered over, and I want to say that niceness has its problems. Niceness and politeness. The politeness of the disciplinary council covered over the violence of what was being done. It allows the leaders to not take responsibility for the damage they do to lives by their judgments and policies. The niceness covers over the complete unfairness of the whole thing. It was a kangaroo court. Finally, my identity and how it has been affected. The power of labeling. Even if I continue to think of myself as a Mormon, I am labeled as an apostate. And even if I don't consider myself a Mormon, this affects my relationship with people around me. All of my extended family are members of the church. And even though they love me and have a long history of my niceness, when the church calls me an apostate, if they want to stay in the church, there's a part of them that has to believe that. I got a letter, my sister-in-law sent a letter out to the family. It was supposed to be nice and nice again, right? We're so nice as Mormons. She had this wonderful experience with her returned missionary son of going to the temple. And she said, I wish that all of my family and Paul's family could be, my family and Ron's family, could my brother Ron, could be worthy of going to the temple. And, you know, what does she expect me to do? You know, this is a call to repentance. It affects my relationship with my family, how they think about me. It affects my alma mater. Even if I say I'm not Mormon, BYU is on my resume. I have 2 degrees from there. I taught there for 14 years. I can't exclude it from my CV. I have to explain my Mormonness. It also affects how I feel about myself. I never thought that I would feel so alienated from the church. I never thought that I would quit wearing garments. I wore this today so that there wouldn't be any question about this. I never thought. I wore my garments a long time after I was denied a temple recommend because I was too outspoken. I wore them for years after I was denied a temple recommend. I never thought I would quit wearing them. If I had time, I had a little joke. Yesterday there was the session, the vagina testimonies, if any of you heard it. I actually liked wearing garments. I even thought they were sexy. You know, some of us don't look good in bikinis, so garments are better than bra and pants. I didn't expect the feelings of sadness and grief because I felt I had gone through all of that during 1993. I had my heart broken by the church. It was like a lover I cared about too much. I'm sad our relationship had to end this way. I'm sad there was so much misunderstanding. I grieve that the church is not a place that I want my daughters to be a part of. I grieve that something I love so much is so intolerant and narrow-minded. I'm so sad about all that loss. But I want to end on the comedy. I ran across a passage from Proverbs 31, that famous passage of the valiant or virtuous woman who does all the traditional woman things about sewing and being prepared and, you know, getting her food supply and all that. But there's a wonderful little verse where it says that the valiant woman is able to laugh at the last day, or you can interpret it as the future. And in context, it seems to be about the fact that she can laugh because she's so prepared with all of her hard work that she doesn't fear bad times. But there's also an ironic interpretation of it, the idea that even in the midst of troubles, if you lost everything, there's a way that you ironically laugh at the whole thing. I'm happy for the things that I can see that I wouldn't have seen without this experience of the last 7 or 10 years. It has revealed my own sense of self-righteousness to me that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. It has made me see the ways that I have excluded others. Paul's mother couldn't come to our temple wedding. It has made me see ways that I have been blind and narrow-minded and judgmental. It has made me see I was too obsessed with religion, and that had a bad effect on my children. It has given me the possibility of wearing beautiful sundresses, just at the point where my arms are beginning to sag and my skin is losing its elasticity. In fact, I have decided that I'm going to start my own normative constituency group of Mormons. My new aim in life is to be a Christian Dior Mormon. My new feminist goal is to improve the fashion sense of Mormon women. Away with those dumpy floral prints, up with haute couture. And finally, to quote Depeche Mode, one of the rock groups, I don't want to start any blasphemous rumors, but I think that God's got a sixth sense of humor, and when I die, I expect to find him laughing.
I've been debating about how to proceed here, and I think the best thing to do actually is to go ahead and present this my response in the other room when and if we get over there. I think that's the.
Okay.
On the same day in 1991, ostensibly by coincidence, Albert Peck and I were both called into our respective stake presidents and stripped of our temple recommends. This action, taken in response to a disobedient Sunstone news story, was perhaps the last official action performed by my outgoing stake president, Craig Vincent. He was released the following week. One of the first actions taken by my incoming stake president, Kerry Hines, was to meet with me and assure me that my recommend would be returned after a respectable waiting period. Kerry's willingness to offer this without requesting any apology, concession, or any promise from me started us off in a very positive relationship that continued until in November 1992, when I discovered that Kerry had issued a written ultimatum to Margaret Toscano. Is that day right? I said 92. Is it 93? 93. Excuse me. Margaret and Paul Toscano had been close friends with the Rector family long before they moved into the Big Cottonwood stake around late 1980s, was it? As an Italian missionary, Paul had served briefly under my father when Dad, who was a member of the First Council of 70 at the time, was asked to extend his trip to Europe to cover the unexpected departure of Paul's mission president. So they got acquainted in that circumstance. Later, my parents published Paul's conversion story in their collection, No More Strangers. In my teens and 20s, I recall Paul coming to our house on occasion, rejoicing with my dad at the dinner table into the night about the expansive truths of the gospel and commiserating about the stark realities of the church. When I was at BYU during the late 70s, Paul was a big man on campus, the epitome of Eric Hoffer's angry young man of ideas. His Jeremiad circulated through the Mormon underground with a breadth and velocity second only to Hugh Nibley himself. At that time, I was experiencing a crisis of faith. My religious experiences had inclined me powerfully toward the conviction that my relationship to God was based entirely on grace rather than on my performance. And my mind could not accept any of the familiar Mormon compromises on that issue. I felt increasingly at odds with what I heard from religious professors and church leaders on what was, to me, the most fundamental religious issue. Paul Toscano was the first Mormon I ever encountered who believed in grace as much as I did. Even more remarkably, Paul convinced me that Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon also shared my view. There was no need to accommodate the non-canonical statements of more recent church leaders who were either beguiled by popular theology or muddled in their thinking, or both. When I met Margaret, I discovered a woman who was fully Paul's equal, intellectually and spiritually, and who had the additional benefit of an even temperament. I thought at the time, this is a remarkable couple. Paul's assurance that it was okay to be a Mormon who was saved by grace, along with my association with Margaret, her sister Janice, Fred Boros, and other neo-Orthodox believers, probably kept me in the church. My resulting desire to make the church a safe place for theological minorities like myself eventually led me to champion Sunstone. Ironically, those who rescued me then are now mostly casualties today. When I read Margaret's letter from my stake president forbidding her to write, speak, or even discuss Mormonism on pain of being dechurched, I felt like I had to do something. I set up a meeting with Carrie, the stake president, to try to dissuade him from following through with this threat. I told him how, in my opinion, Margaret was only fulfilling her baptismal covenant to stand as a witness of Christ in all times and all places. I told how Margaret's words had strengthened my commitment to Christ. And I said that I feared that this action was an abuse of power of the same magnitude as that of the high priest in Acts, who forbade Peter and the apostles to teach about Christ, to whom Peter answered, "We ought to obey God rather than men." Carrie did not receive my words well, and I feared the worst for Margaret. Apparently so did Paul, and so he crafted a paper reminiscent of the BYU days, a fiery diatribe specifically designed to draw fire away from Margaret. His plan worked disastrously well, and we all know what followed that September. Before Paul's excommunication, I set up another meeting with Carrie. This time, there was no air of cordiality. I predicted that by excommunicating Paul, he was effectively excommunicating me and many others. Carrie responded with a prediction of his own. "You wait and see," he said. "Paul Toscano will start his own church." In retrospect, I suppose we were both wrong. I'm still in Carrie's church, and Paul and now Margaret still have none. However, I did feel excommunicated. Back at BYU, I had once wondered if I belonged in the church. But I'd never in my life felt truly angry toward it or estranged from it as I did now. I once again sensed that I had to do something, but I was at a loss of what that could be. I fasted and prayed for direction and got what seemed to be a clear answer. If I really wanted to do something, I could keep right on fasting. Go on a hunger strike. At that moment, I discovered that I was not martyr material. Unwilling to follow the only course that had been clearly laid out to me, I resigned myself to drift. Despite my own brushes with ecclesiastical abuse and my awareness of countless other examples of it, it's strange that I responded so personally to Paul's excommunication. I had a deep admiration for all of the September 6. Each had made major contributions to my faith, even Avram Gileadi. I counted them as true friends and mentors. But if they were all my spiritual relatives, Paul and Margaret were my spiritual family. While the whole purge wounded me spiritually, Paul's excommunication was in some ways the death blow. Not long after that difficult September, a member of the High Council that had excommunicated Paul became my bishop. This exacerbated the problem, as a bishop is not as easily avoided as a stake president or an apostle. I always liked Scott personally, but I felt violated whenever I saw him. When the stake president would show up, it could cause a minor crisis. Once Kerry came unannounced into my elders' quorum to reorganize the elders' quorum presidency, and I was struck with sudden panic. I reflexively bolted from the room and upset him and disrupted the meeting. Eventually, I halfway adopted the Apostle Peter's response to his time of loss and uncertainty when he said, "I go a-fishing." Only for me it was, "I go a-skiing." I took some pleasure in spending occasional Sundays at Snowbird or at the Utah Olympic Park with my children, but I mostly continued attending church out of habit and continue to do so to this day. Rather than having any proper closure or resolution to this issue, after 8 years, I've probably become simply numb to it. I have made my peace with my former high counselor, who is now my former bishop, and I'm ready to do so with my stake president, who is now finally also former. When I heard after the fact of Margaret's excommunication, I was only stunned, not really devastated. Frankly, I'm ashamed of this lack of response, and I'm also puzzled by it. Perhaps I no longer have the energy to feel like I have to do something about it. Perhaps I've already sufficiently mourned Margaret's religious alienation as well as my own. Perhaps in some ways Margaret's excommunication is like the other random acts of violence, religious violence we hear about almost daily today, these days on the other side of the world. Perhaps due to the magnitude and frequency of these atrocities, we all, the perpetrators, the general public, and even to some degree the victims themselves and their families, have become numb to it. If so, that may be the greatest tragedy of all.
I've often felt when I was at BYU, you could tell the people who were not part of the culture, and you can always tell an apostate because they forget to put the middle initial in. Boyd Packer, I haven't heard that without the K for a long time. Second point, my 3-year-old grandson reminded me last week that we shouldn't ever call anyone stupid. Third point, a matter of clarification. I don't know what happened in this particular church council, but there should never be 6 people for and 6 people against. Doctrine and Covenants says there are 6 people who are appointed to make sure that no injustice is done to the individual, and 6 people appointed to make sure that no injustice is done to the church. I hope that is what happened, but if it wasn't, that it should have happened. I also have some sense of sympathy for people who are caught in these very awkward situations. There are 12 men who sit on these councils. I've been there a number of times and have been uncomfortable every time. There are very few men who feel within that context that they can be, they go against a stake president. I found myself sometimes in the unpopular position of being the only one who raised a voice against an excommunication. I think it is part of the limitations of a church that relies on lay leadership. And unfortunately, sometimes what happens is a result of the roll of the dice. My wife's great-grandfather was excommunicated in Idaho, not because he bought flannel for the baby from ZCMI, from the Gentile store instead of ZCMI, because ZCMI was out of it, but because he refused to apologize for doing so. Caroline needed muslin, he said, and I got her muslin. So this happens. As a bishop, I never excommunicated anyone, nor did I ever feel the inclination to do so. The story we've just heard is, to my mind, a very sad story. Every excommunication is, I believe, a number of small deaths. There's something that dies within the individual, within the individual's family and friends, and within the larger community who is affected by that, and I think we all are affected by it. I read Strangers in Paradox a number of years ago and thought it was one of the most wonderfully provocative and imaginative books that I had ever read. It opened my mind in new and startling ways, and I have been very grateful for the kind of thinking and imagining that made that possible. If the church does not feel that it needs hearts and minds like Paul and Margaret Toscano, the Mormon community certainly does. The good news for all of us is the passage in the Book of Mormon that says, Christ is the one who stands at the gate, and he has appointed no other person in his stead. I imagine him opening his arms as he stands at the gate to welcome Levina and Paul and Margaret and many others.
On behalf of all of us, I would like to thank those who participated. Could we give them another hand? All right, we do have some time for questions. I was surprised at how painful it was to rehearse this again. I just remember being, when Margaret told me in November, I just remember being blind with rage. But I guess that time has tempered that to grief. This was a painful experience for me to be here, and I would not have been anyplace else. But we do have time for questions. I'll repeat them into the microphone, and then you can use the microphone on the table, the respondents. Yes, please.
Margaret and Paul, I apologize to your own teacher. Both of you and your daughter were not fulfilling my responsibility. And I apologize on behalf of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for such injustice. This is just a comment. I'm kind of on the fringes, but about 12 years ago, I was sitting out on my back porch reading the tall Scotch and water when the bishopric member came over and asked if I would be in the Sunday school presidency. I laughed and I said, well, I disagree with a particular individual on nearly every point. Why not? Maybe I could reform it. So I served in the Sunday school for about nearly 10 years. And it came to an inglorious end when we lost a counselor. And the president of that time came to me and he said, what do you think? That we want to put somebody in as a counselor. And there is nothing in the handbook and nothing in the other that says we cannot put in a woman. And I'm sitting by that woman that we thought would be just wonderful. Of course, we were released the following week. My heart goes out to you.
Thank you for that anecdote. Yes, please, Mel. Would you repeat the question for the case, Margaret?
The questioner first asked, or first said that it was a very sad story and he felt a lot of sympathy. Then he asked whether or not I had considered not going to the court, quoting the scripture, which seems a little ironic. What is it? Out of thine own mouth will I condemn thee. I guess that I felt that whichever way, whether I went or not, it would probably have the same result.